Mortgages should be illegal because you're getting robbed every month. With a typical $200,000 30-year mortgage, you'll end up paying over $400,000 after interest. Hi, I'm John Commuta, creator of the Transforming Debt into Wealth System. My proven system can eliminate your mortgage and all your debts. Let me send you a powerful free CD. For your free CD, call 1-800-933-2911. 1-800-933-2911. 1-800-933-2911.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone in the franchise world. My name is Paul Segretto, and this is Franchise Today. Today, is my guest will be Shelly Sun, CEO at Brightstar, recent celebrity on Undercover Boss, and author of the new book, Grow Smart, Risk Less. Joining me today also is co-producer Joe Caruso from the great state of Maryland. Joe, how are you today?
Fantastic, Paul. Always a pleasure to be here with you on Franchise Today.
You know, last week we had another good, riveting show as we had two great guests on the show. If you would, give us a recap.
Well, we had Michael Webster, franchise attorney out of Toronto, and Paul Steinberg, a franchise attorney out of New York City, and they recapped the ABA Forum on Franchising conference in Baltimore, which is, this is the 34th year for the conference. And they shared a lot of their insights on franchising, what their take was on a lot of the breakouts and the subject matter covered at the ABA. They did a fine job, and they're great guests. And Michael is a returning guest, and I'm sure we'll have both Michael Webster and Paul Steinberg on again.
Yeah, I'm sure. There was some good information that came out of there with some good discussion regarding KFC and Coverall cases. I think it was a very riveting show. And who do we have coming on future episodes of Franchise Today?
Well, we've got a great episode coming up, a great show on November 17th with an attorney, Mark Fitchman. And the show is called HR Challenges for Franchisees and Franchisors. Why Should You Care About Tattoos, Facebook, and the End of the Alphabet? And we gave kind of a clue about what the end of the alphabet meant on the last show. And it's really talking about the Gen Y and the Gen X generation and how employment has changed because of their upbringing and that particular demographic, and also with technology. So it's going to be very, very interesting, and we'll save the tattoo part for the show. But Mark's going to be a great guest, and I think both franchisors and franchisees will get a lot out of the interaction. And then we break, of course, for Thanksgiving, so we won't have a show that week. But returning in December, on December 1st, we've got a very, very exciting guest. We've got Bob Coleman. He is the person who produces the Coleman Report, which is used by lenders and SBA folks on performance of SBA loans, franchise SBA loans. And his show is going to be The Politics of Lending, Lipstick on a Pig, and What Really Matters to Lenders. So in this economic tumult that we're in right now, and the need for financing for all business, but in particular the audience that listens to Franchise Today, franchisors and their franchisees, this is a not-to-miss show. So we're going to learn a lot about Bob, and Bob has been on national TV. I've watched him on Fox Business News. He's been on Fox News. He's been on a number of other mainstream media outlets, and we look forward to having Bob on the show.
Well, that'll be great. I look forward to both shows, and then, of course, we'll be breaking for the holidays. I think we'll have one more show on December 8th, and then we'll probably break from December 15th until the middle of January, and then, of course, we'll be talking about the IFA convention and upcoming franchise events, and looking forward to have some of the people from the IFA. I know we tentatively have scheduled Steve Caldera for the end of January as well. We'll have to firm up that date. But all in all, I think it'll be good as we lead into the franchise convention in Orlando, Florida. And I'm sure today's guest, of course, will also be there. Shelly Sun is the CEO and co-founder of Bright Star Care, a premium healthcare staffing company providing the full continuum of care from private home care to people of all ages to supplemental staffing for medical facilities, including hospitals, independent assisted living facilities, and doctor's offices. Shelly was selected as the IFA's Entrepreneur of the Year for 2009, becoming not only the youngest recipient of this impressive award, but also only the second female recipient. And then in 2011, Shelly and Brightstar were featured on the hit CBS series Undercover Boss. And I was very happy to help promote that in various social media. It was really a lot of fun leading up to the event. Shelly, welcome to Franchise Today.
Thank you so much.
Well, it is great having you here today, and I think we just, you know, need to get right into it. You wrote a book, Grow Smart, Risk Less, which I've had the pleasure of reading on my travels to the West Coast Franchise Expo last week, and it was really quite enjoyable. Wendy, your assistant, and your chief of staff, which I love the title for your company, sent me a copy and also downloaded it through iTunes. So it's really a great read. And, you know, I went into it and had a totally different perception of what I was going to be reading because I knew it was going to be about you. I knew it was going to be about the Bright Star story. But I didn't realize it was going to be such a textbook, if you would, for new franchisors. And I think that's what really impressed me the most. And so I'd like to start off and just ask you a question that's probably on a lot of people's mind, which is, what was the inspiration for Bright Star?
My husband and I were looking for home care for his grandmother back in late 2001 and had a really hard time finding great quality care that were really compassionate and kind of cared about grandma first. And we regrettably lost her to cancer the day before we got married in early 2002. And it really got us thinking about how hard it was for us to find great home care. Neither of us came from a healthcare background, but we had a strong consumer experience, and we felt very passionate to make a difference and make sure families didn't have to go through what we went through, and really set out to really transform that home care experience, and launched our very first company-owned location in October of 2002.
Well, that's awesome. You know, family is so important nowadays, and for a long time, obviously, but it seems like even more important. I know I did a informal survey with respect to business failure and franchise failure, and not having the type of support at home necessary to sustain a business or even entering a business seemed to be a big problem. How important is family in starting a business?
I think it's critical, and I think it's the if you're married or have a partner, I think it's absolutely your core unit at home, being on the same page with how many hours it will take, the money it will take up front to build something for the future, that that everything else kind of will be second fiddle for a while you're trying to launch a new business. But I think it extends, at least for me, beyond that, is really trying to be diligent about having everyone that you surround yourself with be very positive and upbeat, be energy givers, not energy takers. Because, you know, starting a business is hard, and you're going to have days where you're like, wow, why did I do this? And, I didn't realize it would be so hard. And you want to have people at that right time that are going to encourage you to see it through, not go, well, why did you leave your corporate job? You know, you could go back. And so I found for me that those folks that were not encouraging in my life, whether they were family or friends. I really needed to distance myself when I was in that really heavy stress, high growth stage of the initial stage of our business, when more money is naturally going out than coming in. And I think that's true for any business owner, franchisor, franchisee, entrepreneur, is trying to have a very strong support network, both at home but also in kind of that close circle of family and friends that are going to encourage you during the tougher times.
You know, in your book, Grow Smart, Risk Less, there's five different sections. And as I said, I felt that it was a very strong textbook type for a publication for, you know, new franchisors. And certainly a lot of the mature franchisors can learn a lot from it as well. And it takes us through evaluating the plan, laying the foundation for successful growth, building the franchise family, executing for sustainability, and achieving growth and scale. And then, of course, there are various subchapters in the book. And I love the story at the beginning. If you would, when you found out you were pregnant with twins and then had some bed rest and actually started on the journey of really documenting your trek into franchising. What was that like?
Well, we had an unusual turn of events in 2004. So we'd had a company-owned location that was very successful for a couple of years, and then had an opportunity to become investors in two hotels. So we became franchisees before we were ever a franchisor. We were so passionate about our business, we were just saddened that we couldn't help families everywhere, just the families that were in our immediate area. And making that large of an investment in two hotels, even as a partial owner, you know, I felt compelled to go to new manager training and new owner training with a couple of large hotel systems and saw franchising. And thought, wow, this could be a really great way to find a local, compassionate, passionate owner that's capitalized to leverage our brand, our training, our systems to let them grow and serve families in every market. And so that was in July of 2004 when we invested in the hotels. We, within probably 30 to 60 days of that, finally, after much trying, became pregnant and with twin boys. And in November, I went on bed rest. And for anyone who knows me, I run like an Energizer bunny, always going. And so bed rest was very hard for me. So I had this idea about wanting to make a difference and wanting to expand through franchising, and sat on my computer with a hospital table in my bedroom and set about writing my operations manuals, documenting everything that had made us successful in a company-owned location to plan for after the birth of our baby boys, that we would give birth to a franchising brand to expand and help entrepreneurs become our franchisees and make a difference in their community with Bright Star Care.
Now, you also said, though, in your book that you actually had some staff meetings in your bedroom while you're on business.
I sure did. I mean, I'm a CPA by background, so I clearly love numbers, but I'm also a big people person. And so having that connectivity to my staff, I mean, my staff are like my family, and, you know, we still have performance goals and things like that, but not having that interaction was really tough for me. So they put up with me and would come over to the house once a week to do staff meetings during the time that I had to be on bed rest.
That's great. So what was the defining moment in taking the company from a corporate operations to a franchise system?
I mean, I think really being exposed to seeing how well we actually went through training with Choice Hotels, who Steve Joyce is the CEO of, went through and was so impressed by how, not coming from the hotel industry, we could be fully trained to, you know, replicate a successful business model. And I had always wanted, even in our original business plan, didn't know the distribution method, but always wanted to be able to deliver our healthcare services, you know, around the country and eventually around the world and make a difference in terms of the quality of care. And franchising, after exposure to it, made a lot of sense as as to an ability to keep control over the quality and the branding and the customer experience, but being very diligent on the selection of good people who were going to be in it for the right reasons, but also were committed to doing what it takes to grow a small business and get it to the point of being successful. And franchising seemed to kind of marry those two things for me, a great distribution model with a great group of people to be able to help more families everywhere.
You know, Joe and I, Joe Caruso, co-producer on Franchise Today and a very well-known franchise executive, and I have hours upon hours of conversations, and we talk a lot about culture, and we talk a lot about systems. And Joe, did you have a question for Shelley with respect to any of that?
Well, I have a comment and possibly a question. You know, I met Shelley and JD when they were in the initial stages of the launch of their franchise at the Franchise Finance Conference in Minneapolis. And I recall, you know, you peppering me with a lot of questions about franchising and practical business methods and best practices. And it was interesting watching you work the room because you were just soaking up all of the energy and all of the information. And for people who haven't been to the Franchise Finance Conference or the Restaurant Finance Conference, it's a great environment for learning. It's a great environment for making contacts within franchising. But what would you say, Shelley, back at that stage, and I think I met you in either 2006 or 2007, what was going through your mind at that point in time when you were just really getting immersed into the franchise culture and the franchise distribution model?
Absolutely. I think you're right. I mean, I think for the first 2 to 3 years, I just really became a student of franchising. I think I quickly realized that while I'm in the business of healthcare, to be a great franchisor, I had to not only be able to be great at healthcare, I had to be great at franchising, and I had to know how to help franchisees be successful. And I had run a healthcare business for 2.5 years at that point, but I hadn't run a franchise. And so I wanted to learn from those that had been around and done it before me. And I found that so many people were willing to share with me what had gone right and what had gone wrong. And I just tried to be a sponge and, you know, listen to the, you know, words of Rocco Fiorentino or Brian Schnell or Kurt Landwehr or Jeff Hill. I mean, so many people mentored me. I mean, I probably have 30 or 40 people that have constant contact with that I began talking to in my first couple of years in franchising. And what really compelled me to think about how could I take that working of the room and all of those best practices that I gathered? I mean, I think that the Bright Star success story is not a Shelley Sun or JD Sun success story, but a franchising industry success story, because really it was all of the lessons learned from so many people that were so willing to share, and how could I take all of those lessons learned and all of those contacts that I made and who are the best suppliers and what are the right conferences to go to, and really for a brand new franchisor that may not have been as lucky to find the mentors very early on like Lane Fisher and Brad Fishman that, you know, introduced me to everyone in franchising, you know, that might not have had the same path, to create for them a way to go step by step to have a similar successful experience in forming a franchise company. And Brian Schnell, who's on my board of advisors, a really prominent franchise attorney, had been on me for about a year to write the book. He goes, you've seemed to have done everything right, or at least where you've made the mistakes, you've corrected. And from a culture perspective, you really care about your franchisees being successful. All you talk about is franchisee unit economics and how can you constantly improve that. And all of your people speak the same thing. If you could just help new franchisors have that same philosophy and that same approach, franchising in general would be stronger. And because I felt like I had taken so much from the industry in the early stages, it really was hopefully my opportunity to not make it about Shelley and JD, as Paul spoke about, but really have it be a way of giving back to help it be the playbook or the step-by-step guide on hopefully doing franchising right from the franchisee's perspective.
You know, and I love obviously I love the book. There's a particular passage in here that I want to read that I think strikes to the point that you just made. And it said franchisors can be successful for short periods of time regardless of how their franchisees perform. But the franchisors who enjoy the greatest long-term success follow a model in which the majority of their franchisees can make money, can succeed, and are highly satisfied with the franchisor-franchisee relationship. In particular, the founder-CEO must have passion and commitment to a relentless pursuit of improving franchisee unit economics. And I think that's just a compelling statement. Certainly, you and JD definitely show the passion for your brand and the passion for your business. Explain some of your thoughts behind franchisee success and unit economics.
Well, I think it starts with selecting the right franchisees. And so, you know, understanding over time if there are similarities on franchisees that are more successful and being disciplined to select those franchisees, and similarly looking if there's common characteristics or backgrounds or experiences of those that are struggling or underperforming and don't have the discipline to turn down the checks, to not have people joining your system that may not have what it takes to be successful. So I think it starts with selection. And then it starts with, you know, making the investment to give them the right tools and training and resources to be successful. I mean, we've got a very heavy infrastructure of people to help our franchisees. We are about one full-time staff for every four franchisees. And so, you know, we really have made a commitment to infrastructure, recognizing that our franchisees are going to need us more in their first 24 months than they'll need us throughout our entire relationship combined after 2 years. And so making sure that in our early stages of franchisor, we've invested to have those resources when they need it. And then, you know, we may be able to double or triple or quadruple our number of franchisees and only minimally increase our infrastructure from here on out. But it's a front-loaded investment, much like our franchisees are making a front-loaded investment. You know, they'll spend, you know, all of their investment range for the most part, you know, in the very early stages of the business. I guess we want to match our pain points and our success journey together, that we're willing to invest up front while franchisees are investing up front. And as franchisees are successful over time, we too will be successful over time.
The you know, as you're venturing into the franchise side of business, you know, obviously you must have hit some bumps in the road. Is there anything in particular that stands out in your mind as a bump in the road as you transitioned from corporate operations to franchising?
I think two key lessons learned that we had to go through, and I talk about in detail in the book, because I think from your mistakes you probably have the greatest learning, but hopefully you can help others avoid the same mistake. So the first would be really truly understanding the capitalization necessary, not just to launch a franchise system, but to get to where the franchise system is royalty self-sufficient. And what I mean by royalty self-sufficient is there are more recurring revenues coming in than expenses are going out the door. And so I think for new franchisors, they plan on franchise fees, you know, from the sale of a franchise. And then when new franchise sales aren't happening, they can be upside down from an infrastructure perspective and from a capitalization perspective if they haven't planned appropriately. So that was my first lesson learned when we, you know, were $200,000 short of what it really was going to take to stay at it and grow a successful brand. And we had to go, you know, hat in hand to family to help us out. We paid it back within 12 months, but, you know, it was a really tough time. And so I can sympathize with, you know, other business owners that are kind of going through that stage. And but I think if you're really passionate about what you believe in, and you know it can be successful, timing may just have gotten in the way that you press ahead and you move forward. The second one was really fully understanding that once I made a decision to be a franchisor, I needed to be a franchisor the majority of my time, and I didn't move quickly enough to backfill myself to oversee the company-owned location and tried to do both, and that didn't do that didn't really create for a successful opportunity to continue to grow my company-owned store. In fact, it suffered pretty substantially, not having my oversight of it. But I felt like I owed it to my franchisees that if they were writing these checks and joining my system, that my attention needed to be focused on them. And so, you know, a lesson learned would have been to plan an increased level of capitalization, bring in a leadership person to run my company-owned location so that me as a founder could focus on my franchisees and not feel guilty if I'm 100% focused on my franchisees and my company-owned store is suffering or vice versa.
You know, as young franchisors or aspiring franchisors consider when contemplating the move towards franchising, there's a host of different things that run through their mind. And, of course, like you said, a lot of them start thinking about making ends meet through franchise sales, and as we know, that's a surefire recipe for failure. The thing that impressed me as I was reading through the book, it seemed like you and JD made two big investments. The first was in human resources along the way, as your book progresses along in your trek from starting as a franchise to today, and it shows how you've added various layers of management and brought in different people to fill different roles to take the company and yourself in a different, you know, in a more progressive direction. And the second one was with respect to investing in technology. And too often than not, we see today a lot of brands start up and don't make those necessary investments. Even as they start progressing along, it's more reactive than proactive. How important was making the let's talk about human resources first. How important was it make those investments along the way with respect to adding key people every step of the way?
I think critically important to our success, because I think, you know, there have been a lot of high growth industries and, you know, anything having to do with children or seniors, wellness, you know, have been very high growth industries. And so if you know the business is going to come, then we didn't want to be in a situation of going and hiring people. And if they don't come from healthcare, having them take 6 to 12 months to ramp up. And even if they do come from healthcare, since we were the first brand that had the full continuum of care, including skilled care, it would take them probably 3 to 6 months to ramp up. And so if we were always hiring after we had already sold the franchises, then our new franchisees were getting a subpar experience, and that's not what they paid for. So I think the reason we didn't just grow fast but grew smart was our ability to invest ahead of the growth but be prudent about not just investing for investment's sake, but being able to look at what was the growth trajectory for all of my competitors that had kind of come before me to know how quickly I may grow and then be able to plan the organization ahead of time, allowing 3 to 6 months for experienced industry people and 6 to 12 months for those positions that I might pull outside the healthcare industry.
You know, throughout your book, I love the little statements that are avoid this pitfall, and you speak directly towards your own experience, such as on page 68, it says, avoid this pitfall, and it says, I didn't invest in having a leader oversee the company-owned operations while I focused on my franchisees. And I love these pitfalls along the way because they really stand out. And they really tie into what you're talking about right at that particular time, but they're just very powerful statements, and I certainly thank you for putting those in the book that way, because it definitely was very impactful. When you talked about investing in technology, what was some of your thoughts behind it? I think initially, if I recall correctly, you invested in software for day-to-day operations that was specific to the company operations, so it seemed technology was paramount right from the beginning. And what were your thoughts all along the way?
Well, I wanted to ensure a consistent quality delivery to our end consumer, and so investing in technology allowed me to do that in my company-owned store, but certainly set the stage for being able to replicate out a consistent customer experience over time. But I think what I've seen, which, you know, sometimes you're smart and sometimes you're lucky, is I think the biggest benefit that we had that our technology was in place before we ever franchised. And talking to other franchisors, I think many are envious that, you know, every transaction that's ever been done by a franchisee is in our database. And so we're able to help franchisees understand, are you ahead or behind of where you should be this week? And so, you know, being able to have real-time data for our franchisees, I mean, you know, you buy a business as a franchisee to be in business for yourself but not by yourself. We really bring that to life because our franchisees really are able to know if they're ahead or behind on margin. Are they ahead or behind on revenue? Are they ahead or behind on profitability by benchmarking them against every other franchisee in our system at a similar period of time and being able to help them know what is top quartile, what is second quartile, what is third, and what is fourth look like so they know where they're performing and helping them with an action plan to make improvement based upon where they may be falling short. And so I think it was a great back-end office efficiency issue was the reason we made the investment initially, but I think the biggest benefit of my technology today is actually the ability to aggregate the data and use it to help our franchisees make better decisions and improve their performance over time.
When we're talking about aspiring franchisors that are contemplating the move towards franchising, obviously a lot of aspiring franchisors have a hard time dealing with the franchise model because they don't want to give up control. And one of the things that really struck me in your book, too, was the section when you spoke about transitioning from the founder to the CEO, where apparently you've already given up some control to key people, and obviously you have franchisees running with the ball. How hard is it to make that transition from founder to CEO?
I think it can be difficult emotionally, but for me, I think if you've got good guardrails to really be able to inspect what you expect, I think abdicating authority and not checking in on the results is dangerous, first of all, and secondly, can harm the brand. I think for me, I think when I have transitioned some day-to-day authority, I still have reports that are allowing me to inspect what's being done to make sure it's meeting my expectations. And where I feel like we might be losing a little bit of touch based upon the distance from me to my franchisee, I step back in. And so I don't do that forever, and I don't, but I do it to be a learning moment for my staff about why I stepped in, what I did, and how to make that a repeatable event by them through new learning, training, and heart that may have been missing in what we were delivering from to a franchisee. And then as a founder, and because my money is still all at risk, there's certain things that I still absolutely have come to me, even though I have a day-to-day president involved. Anything that changes policy, any default notice that we're issuing to a franchisee, and any change in agreement on a brand new franchisee, which is, you know, almost unheard of, but on some of the master agreements we're doing outside the U.S. As we're kind of venturing out into new territory, a little bit more modification might be necessary. And so I kind of have the guardrails for when do I still need to make sure that even though I'm not running a lot of the day-to-day, that the things that are critical that could impact the health of our business long-term, I'm involved in those decisions. So I think for me as a founder, understanding what things do I still want to stay involved in and making sure that that's very clearly articulated and documented. And then for the things that I have transition authority, how am I going to be able to spot check and inspect that what my expectations are being fulfilled?
We're speaking here today with Shelley Sun, CEO at Brightstar and author of the new book, Grow Smart, Risk Less, today on Franchise Today. Shelley, in your book, you speak about growing your organization from within, and I know when you contemplated bringing on a president of the company, to handle more of the day-to-day operation. You did so from within. And throughout the book, as I mentioned, you have the avoid the pitfalls, and there's also another little moniker there, which is a little light bulb. And the one in particular I read, it says, our breakthrough came with recognizing that leadership was responsible for ensuring that employees were being developed for their future roles and understood the opportunities the future held. What was some of your thought process behind that and how it led to nurturing an individual that was in the organization that eventually became your president?
Well, I think, you know, an organization is only as strong as its people, and you need to recognize who your top performers are, both in attitude but in terms of competencies that can be developed, and make that investment. I think it's hard to make that investment in every single employee, so I think I'm realistic about really looking at kind of who are my top 10, which I talk about in the book. You know, and we will move to who are the top 25 and really looking at the top 50% of our organization, make sure they've got two-year development plans. We're investing in continuing education. I've got 12 people in my company going through CFE, Certified Franchise Executive Program, through the IFA, and that's not an inexpensive investment. We bring 10 to 12 people to the IFA convention every year just to expose our organization. And considering I only have 60 employees, but you know, 20% of my organization are coming to convention, that's a pretty significant investment. But I believe it's important to nurture them. And I believe that my personnel that have the same passion for my franchisee's success, I can't train passion. So if they have that innately, that they would love to be an entrepreneur but didn't want to take the risk, but they love making it easier and enabling success for those that have jumped off the cliff and taken that risk and our franchisees, those are people that I want to make an investment with. And so that's been our philosophy. Very similarly, when I looked at a president and I was looking externally and an individual who had an amazing track record. And as I, you know, dealt with a few of my mentors, my strategic coach, who's outside the franchise industry, but Rocco Ferrentino and Jeff Hill, and helping me kind of think through that decision, knowing that I'd been a founder and I knew every franchisee and their spouse and their kids and, you know, the age of their kids, and it's just so, my hands were on everything. You know, both Rocco and Jeff said those shoes are really hard to fill. Now they tend to be 4-inch heels, so they really are hard to fill. But thinking about how much better would it be for you to bring in someone a level below and spend a couple years having them earn the respect of the franchisees, so that when you transition from you to a president, it isn't like, you know, their best friend just left them, you know, right? That they understand that you're there to do the vision and do the strategy, and there's someone tactically operating the day-to-day and how you two will work together. Much easier to do that than someone who doesn't have that relationship already with the franchisees, and they feel like the rug's been kind of pulled out from under them, that someone new is coming out that they're interfacing with, and they no longer really have the immediate access to me anymore. And so I think it served very well to try to develop, particularly key roles that are very franchisee-facing, to develop those from within, where the franchisees already have their respect, so they're going to listen to them. Because if you think about the role of a franchisor is to coach a franchisee to reach their highest potential, you can only coach if you have mutual respect, and that takes time to acquire. And so if it's something that someone in a marketing position has an ability to potentially become a field support rep to support my franchisees, but the franchisees already love them in marketing, I will consider, you know, grooming them and promoting them to a field support position, because the hardest thing to develop is that mutual respect and that relationship to be able to give coaching advice. I can teach them the skills of, you know, how do you use this action plan and how do you look at this report and see how the franchisee is doing, but that basic level of mutual respect that makes any conversation possible, because the franchisee knows that it's coming from a good place, that's something that's harder to bring from outside the organization in.
Yeah, absolutely. I do agree with that. Joe, did you have a comment?
The comment I have is that Shelley, with Brightstar, you've really traveled the road less traveled in terms of what typically happens with emerging franchise brands. the anecdotal evidence is that about 75% of startup franchisors fail. And there's hard to pin down, but there's certainly a great number of what I call zombie franchisors, where they started out, they franchised a few units, and they found out for whatever reason that the unit economics didn't work or they weren't suited to be franchisors. And they don't go out of business, but they really aren't actively franchising anymore. So you have exceeded and beat the odds where other franchisors have not. And I think what's really ringing true is that it wasn't an accident. It's because you had a plan, and it's because you followed your plan. And you had some great people to help you. I mean, Brian Schnell is a good friend, and a great resource and a fantastic franchise attorney. You're lucky to have him. That's my only comment on the difference between what you've done and what others have maybe failed to do.
Thank
yes,
you.
Definitely. Looking at the this book, a play by play, if you would, in the playbook towards franchise success, Grow Smart and Risk Less, is definitely a very well-defined plan, and certainly I'm real appreciative that you've shared this with the community, for sure. You know, going back, I was remiss. I started to ask you a question with respect to investment in human resources, but also technology. And in the book, as we get towards the middle of the book, you said, we see greater opportunities to accelerate our franchisees' results and our own with a large number of technology enhancements that will be completed in 2011. How important is it for a new franchisor to realize the necessity of making investments in technology and then staying up with technology moving forward?
I think it's critical, but I think that, you know, depending on the budget and depending on how successful their company-owned location is, and whether they're using technology in their company-owned location before they franchise, I think, you know, looking at the alternatives of, you know, is there a system to buy, which is, and you're only paying a certain amount per month, versus, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars up front to build a technology from scratch. And so I think technology is important. I think understanding the best technology for what a franchisor does, and then having every franchisee mandated on the same platform so you can get the information back out with which to make great decisions, is an important decision up front for a franchisor. That doesn't mean they have to be the one to spend millions of dollars to create their own like we did. We only built our own because we couldn't find technology that accommodated the full continuum of care and staffing. We could find home care solutions, or we could find staffing solutions. We couldn't find a system that did both, and so we had to solve that problem. But, you know, as a new franchisor, and if I could find a technology for quick service restaurants or for, you know, pet grooming, or, you know, whatever it was, and that technology existed on the marketplace and the vendor was very receptive to giving me back all of my franchisees' data, as long as I committed that I was going to make it mandatory in my franchise agreement that every franchisee signed up for that technology solution and capped the price, then I think you can have the best of both worlds without the huge upfront investment that investing in your own technology may have.
Another pitfall that I read in the book: the mistake that many franchisors make in the early years is to sell franchises to almost anyone who is willing to sign the franchise agreement and pay the initial franchise fee. How important, and I know Joe knows and I know, but I'd like you to share with a lot of the young franchise professionals that are listening today, how important is it to avoid that pitfall?
I think it really is probably the biggest difference between franchisors that make it beyond 5 years and those that don't, are the selection of the franchisees, because it only takes one bad franchisee and a $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 settlement to undo everything that a new franchisor has done. Now, fortunately, we've never had a litigation settlement or litigation with any franchisee, but I think our selection criteria, JD and I, because we're founders and we're both in the business, and I knew I'd have to support them, we've had a no-jerk rule from the very beginning. And so, you know, we really were diligent, even though we had two or three people who I would not want to support a year later write checks and be demanding about us taking it, that we refused. And it's so hard to do. I understand that in the early stages of franchising in particular. It's hard to turn down a check when you're trying to grow. But even with trying to do all the things right, you still potentially will make a mistake and get someone in as a franchisee that, while not a jerk, won't follow your model. And I think for a new franchisor, even if you've only sold three or five or seven franchises, I think as early as possible, and I learned this from many franchisors that I had talked to, is as early as possible, have a resale program that's robust and strong, and resale agreements with brokers to be able to help franchisees sell their business, so that you can go to an underperforming franchisee or a difficult franchisee and steer them towards a different path of, this isn't working, but here we can help you exit. And if there's not a resale program in place, just having them close their doors isn't good for the franchisor, nor is it good from a franchisee for recovering some of their investment.
Excellent point. And another pitfall that's along those lines, and I think there's a key point here. You say, remember, the wrong franchisee is expensive, not only in terms of dollars to support and lost royalty opportunity, and this is the key, but also in terms of the emotional toll and distraction. And share some of your thoughts on that.
Well, I think that if you've hired for culture throughout the franchisor organization, we all get up in the morning, we all go to bed at night thinking about helping our franchisees be successful. And when you have a franchisee that fails, I think it's that's hard for the entire organization, because it feels like a failure. Regardless of whether it was our failure or their failure to follow the model or use the model, it still is very hard on the employees to know that they lost one that they were rooting for and supporting. And so I think there's a lot of hidden costs that go with having a franchisee fail that are really important to think about, all of those costs. So when you think about a $30,000 franchise fee compared to the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars of lost morale and lost resources and opportunity cost of putting those resources elsewhere, I think it helps set things in perspective to make sure you're not making bad short-term decisions that really dramatically cause your long-term potential to be hampered.
Chapter 6, I think, is really paramount for every new and mature franchise system to read and refer to, and it's implementing an effective franchise sales process. And I know we could probably talk two more shows at least on everything in here, but it talks about mapping the sales process. It talks about the five-step process, the opportunity, competitive advantage, joining the team day, et cetera, and I highly recommend pick up Shelley's book, Grow Smart, Risk Less, and read through it very carefully. And as Shelley points out at the beginning of the book, read through it and then go back and refer to the different chapters and the different sections. It's really fantastic. What are some of the unexpected things that aspiring franchisors need to contemplate or need to be aware that possibly could occur that you might be able to share from your experience?
Well, I mean, just thinking about even just the chapter that you just referenced, because I think that the success of a franchise system is all about the franchisees that are in the system. And so I think one thing that took us a little while to figure out, but that really serves us well today, is building that franchise sales process to validate that your candidate will follow a system. So at each stage of our sales process, we actually give homework. And so if they won't follow the homework and do what we're asking them to do before they write a check, they likely won't do so after they write a check and become a franchisee. So it really becomes a great way for us to add one more layer to a good interview of a franchise candidate to make sure they're going to be a good cultural fit and ultimately have an opportunity to be successful. any franchisee who won't follow the model, I don't know why they become a franchisee in the first place, but it happens, to be able to have a way to spot check their ability to follow directions and follow the system and listen is important, I think, before they ever become your franchisee. And then I think for a franchisor that really wants to succeed long term is really understanding how they make money. I'm always amazed when I go to a conference and they ask about, you know, what's the number one way that franchisors make money? And, you know, 90% of the hands go up in the room and they're all yelling, franchise fees, franchise fees. And really, the right answer, which it always gets to that, is it's about royalties and that recurring revenue stream. Well, the initial franchise fee you can get just for showing up and just signing an agreement, to get the royalties and have those grow mean you have to be all about helping franchisees be successful. And I think the franchisors that invest and think about how do they maximize royalties, which means maximizing the revenues that their franchisees are able to drive, are really those that are the most successful. And those that focus on increasing franchise fees by just getting people through the door are the ones that we are probably in that 75% failure rate that you quoted.
You know, an excellent section on executing for sustainability that leads into how does the franchisor make money is an excellent chapter as well. You know, many say that entrepreneurs don't always make good franchisees. What's your opinion on that?
I think that both franchisor and franchisee need to be entrepreneurial enough to be willing to take a risk and to keep at it in the face of all adversity and put on the happy face for your employees and your customers every day. And so I think that's where, you know, that the entrepreneurial drive and passion is both important for franchisor and franchisee. I think for both franchisor and franchisee, though, it's also important that both sides understand what each one's role is, and that it's the importance of the system. And so the franchisor needs to be all about protecting the system, protecting the brand, and making the decisions that fulfill that. And the franchisee needs to be entrepreneurial enough to find ways to improve or find new revenue sources, but not so outside the box or renegade of a entrepreneur that they won't follow the model to begin with. So in my way, I would say that from a franchisee perspective is they need to be able to follow the entire business model, and they may be entrepreneurial enough that they're able to give back to the system by suggesting, you know, 5 to 20% improvements that allow them to tap into their entrepreneurial creativity, but in a way that they're working with their franchisor to pilot a program, share the information, and then mutually agree whether those new programs should be rolled out system-wide or not. And I think that this establishing the culture up front about we want you to be innovative, but we want you to learn the model first. One thing that I do in training with our brand new franchisees is say, get out your notepad. Every great idea that you have about changing the model, I want you to write it down on this notepad for the next 12 months. And then once you learn the reason why it's not a good idea, come back in and cross out the ones that you will discover won't be really good ideas once you know more. And at the end of 12 months, we're happy to look at what those great ideas are, but you need to know the business model first. And the people who aren't offended by that are entrepreneurial enough to be successful as a franchisee, and those that aren't should probably be out on their own and not in a franchise brand.
Let's shift gears a little bit, and let's go to the Shelly Sun in blue scrubs, tennis shoes, and short dark wig, leaving behind the high-end shoes. And so we're of course referring to your experience on the hit reality show Undercover Boss. Share some of your experience with that. That had to be very enjoyable and enlightening, but probably a little bit stressful as well.
It was an amazing experience. I mean, JD and I got into the business to make a difference through home care. And so the excitement of franchising was to help more families. The fear of franchising is that a franchisee may not do for a family what I would do myself. And so having an opportunity to truly go undercover and see on the front line that our franchisees were doing the things for the families that made me so proud was kind of a once-in-a-lifetime experience. I think the interesting kind of behind-the-scenes pieces that people may not realize about the show is I didn't even know which locations they were going to. So these were not our best of the best franchisees. These were not our highest-performing franchisees, and these were not our best caregivers that were working for the franchisees. So the behind the scenes is giving them a list of every franchise location. And as a franchisor, that makes you a little bit nervous because you've got top, middle, and you might have some that you've got in an action plan scenario. And then having them go to those locations and interview behind closed doors about 200 caregivers and have them decide. And I was not able to know even where they were fine-tuning to where I was going. I didn't know what city I was even flying to until I checked in at the airport. So, you know, trying to really keep the CEO, who's in control of everything, off her game to have to go into the scenario. But it made me so much more proud knowing that I wasn't going in and just inspecting my top locations. I was going into a random sample of franchisees, a random sample of caregivers, and all of them I would hire to take care of my own twin boys that are 6 years old and the love of my life, or for my mother or my father who passed away 2 years ago to take care of them. That made me so proud, and I don't know of any other way I could have gone in and seen the quality or inspected the quality as Shelley's son, but as Linda, I was able to do that.
I'm so happy that you explained that to us, because I'm sure you know the perception is that those locations and franchisees were handpicked. So thank you for sharing that, because I think a lot of people had the perception that they were handpicked. You know, we're closing in at the top of the hour, and we probably could talk another 2 hours at least. But I know in your book you refer to it a lot, and I'm talking about the IFA, and I know you're heavily involved in the IFA. How important is it for new franchisors to work with the International Franchise Association?
I think if you're not going to be heavily involved in the International Franchise Association, don't franchise. And if you're already a franchisor and not involved, get involved today. And if you're not going to make that commitment, stop franchising. Because so much of my success is because of the education that I was able to obtain. I mean, within my first 18 months of being a franchisor, I became a certified franchise executive. I was passionate about learning. If I was going to do something, I was going to do it right and from a place of understanding, not thinking how I would be a good franchisor. I wanted to know what it took to be a good franchisor. And it's such a giving organization. I mean, the networking that goes on at conventions and at, you know, we're headed next week to the Executive Leadership Conference in Miami with, you know, C-level executives of franchisors, those kind of events are just so powerful for the networking and the sharing. Learn from those that have already made the mistakes and had the successes so you can find the path to success and avoid some of the paths to mistakes. I think it's an amazing organization that is a huge value for what it costs to be a member of the association and what you get back.
Very good. So where does Shelley's son go from here? What's on the horizon?
Well, I'm enjoying being able to have an opportunity to talk to so many young franchisors that are reading the book and, you know, want to kind of talk about kind of their path and journey. Our hope and ambition may be in the next 12 months or so to launch a consulting company to help new franchisors do it right. What I'd like to be able to create as a differentiation is having the answer to be don't franchise or don't franchise now be an acceptable answer, because franchising is expensive and you really need to do it only knowing that your franchisees can make money and the franchisor can make money in a reasonable period of time. Otherwise, you know, it's $100,000, $150,000 of a waste of investment if you're not sustainable. And so consulting's on the horizon and just really try to continue to make a difference in an industry that's made such a difference for me. And then I see additional brands. We're looking at an assisted living concept. We just secured land to build our first assisted living facility with one of our franchisees as a pilot. And then we'll launch another franchise brand hopefully in 2013 and start looking at new franchisees to continue to grow and expand what BrightStar is able to provide to families across the country.
You know, you end the book by saying, as the leader, you own the responsibility for setting the vision, building the organization, and establishing the culture. Certainly, it's apparent that you and JD have done that. And the last sentence I really admire, and it says, don't forget to enjoy the journey. And always seeing the smile on your face, I know you've enjoyed the journey. And I really thank you for being my guest today on Franchise Today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, Paul. I really appreciate it.
Joe, we've got about a minute and a half. Any parting comments?
I am so impressed with what, Shelley, you've done with Brightstar. And going back to one of your earlier comments about, you know, employing technology at an early stage and the benefits that, that are accrued by doing so. But what I really hear you saying is the discipline of reporting. And that's a huge error that many nascent franchisors make, is that they don't get good reporting, either because they don't know how to do it or they're fearful of offending the franchisees by, you know, requiring them to report. And I, before the show, I had a chance to take a look at your franchise disclosure document, and you have one of the most detailed Item 19 financial performance representations that I've seen. And you couldn't have achieved it had you not had the reporting. And so those franchisors that cop out say, well, I don't really want to do the technology piece. Well, you don't have to do the technology piece, but you do have to do the reporting piece.
Absolutely.
Yep, absolutely, yeah. Joe, who do we have on again next Thursday?
Mark Fidgman. He's going to be talking about tattoos, Facebook, and the end of the alphabet. And it's going to be great HR information for both franchisors and franchisees. He's a very accomplished HR attorney and an employment attorney, and should be a great show.
It definitely should be. Until next week, I'm Paul Segreto, wishing you the best, the very best, in this great thing we call franchising. Franchise Today is out.